Good morning, members. I think we're online and ready to commence. So again, we'll do the introductions of the SAT, starting with Steve Weisberg.
Good morning, Steve Murray. Steve Weisberg from the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project Authority.
Stephen Stokes, Southwest Fisheries Science Center.
Susan Chiver, Southwest Fisheries Science Center.
Good morning, Chris Costello from UC Santa Barbara.
Good morning, Steve Works, Cal Fish and Game.
Good morning, from the University of Washington. Dan Ponda, Sonoma College.
Dominic Gregorio of the State Water Board.
Ken Wiseman, MLPA Initiative.
Larry Allen, Cal State Northridge and the Southern California Marine Institute.
Steve Murray from Cal State Fullerton.
Mark Carr, University of California at Santa Cruz.
Melissa Miller-Henson, Marine Life Protection Act Initiative.
Mary Gleason, MLPA Initiative.
Craig Schumann, MLPA Initiative. Evan Fox, MLPA Initiative.
Kevin Fleming, State Parks.
Pete Ramondi, UC Santa Cruz.
Rich Ambrose, UCLA.
Stephen Morgan, UC Davis.
Paul Dayton, Scripps.
Astro Charles Ecotrust and Oregon State University.
Dan Robinette, PRBO Conservation Science.
Eric Bjorkstead, National Marine Fisheries Service and Humboldt State University.
Okay, the next task before us is to take a quick review of the agenda and approve this for us to proceed. As you can see, we're going to hear some updates regarding the calendar and from the recent Fish and Game Commission and Blue Ribbon Task Force meeting. We'll be moving then on to item number two, which has to do with MPA design guidelines and evaluation methods. We'll be dealing with habitat representation, size and spacing, habitat replication, and levels of protection. After lunch, we'll be entertaining public comment, and then we'll be having mostly a series of updates dealing with MPA design guidelines and evaluation methods, an update on modeling tools, evaluation tools, birds and mammals, habitat quality, the beach manipulation activities, species likely to benefit from MPAs. We'll be then entertaining some of the science questions that have been asked of the group to look at how we might proceed to address some of those. And then we'll be concluding with a quick look at the proposed presentations that will be given by SAT members at an upcoming meeting. So I'd like to have a motion to approve the agenda. Can I have that?
So moved. So.
Moved by Astrid, seconded by Rich. All in favor? Any objections? Abstentions? So the agenda stands as it is. We'll move on now to the SAT calendar update. Melissa.
So whoever's phone that was, thank you for the reminder because I forgot to turn off mine. The only update to the calendar is actually a change to the July 2009 Blue Ribbon Task Force meeting. Your dates have not changed for your meetings, so the schedule that you received is still accurate. The task force meeting in July changed by a week, so it's a week later than was originally scheduled. But otherwise, all of the dates that had previously been approved are still the same.
Let's now hear the update on the joint meeting of the California Fish and Game Commission and the MLPA Blue Ribbon Task Force. Ken and Mark are going to do this. Who would like to go first?
Maybe I can give kind of the overview, and Mark was there talking in detail. As you recall, the commission had requested your advice on the Northern Channel Islands, the Sanctuary Islands, as to the status of those reserves, how they should be treated. They had sent a signal in the summer that they were probably inclined to not want to change them, but wanted the scientific background and plus a report on what had happened there the last 5 years. They did send that guidance that indeed they do not want to change any of the existing reserves in the sanctuary, but that and that those reserves are to play into your accounting for be part of proposals that are submitted. But the Southern Channel Islands are obviously still in play, and to that end, we also had a recommendation that is being discussed about the Department of Defense desire to not have San Clemente Island used, but the science pointing to the fact that San Clemente and Catalina are tied as an ecosystem. So we've had discussions with the Department of Defense that is an issue that will be driven by the science, and you will be hearing more about that as time goes forward. So, Marka, you can probably talk to the specifics of.
Well, just quickly, I was going to summarize the activity of the SAT at these last two meetings. So on December 10th was the Blue Ribbon Task Force meeting, and at that meeting, the presentations that were given to the RSG were repeated to the Blue Ribbon Task Force. So that was Larry Allen's description of the habitat types in the South Coast Study Region and the species assemblages associated with those habitats and their distributions. And then I gave the presentation that Jen Cassell gave previously to the RSG, which was the summary of scientific knowledge of fish movement, adult movement, and larval dispersal, and their implications for MPA size and spacing. And then on December 11th, there was a joint meeting between the Fish and Game Commission and the Blue Ribbon Task Force, at which they received a synthesis or summary of the five-year evaluation that had been conducted for the existing marine reserve system in the Northern Channel Islands. And then they received a presentation from me again on the SATs, the MLPA SATs evaluation of those existing marine reserves, which is the evaluation that was presented to you guys at the last SAT meeting.
One thing I neglected to do was introduce the chairman of our Blue Ribbon Task Force, who is with us today here, Don Benninghoven, and we thank Don for being here and his continued leadership. Thanks.
Excuse me, and I should mention, because when Don stood up, I looked at Eric Bjorkstedt right there, who had a disgusted look on his face, because in addition to, and this is actually quite important, in addition to the SAT evaluation of the Northern Channel Islands, Eric gave a really nice presentation on the connectivity models and the implications of those connectivity models for understanding the relationship of the Northern Channel Islands with the rest of the system.
I wasn't disgusted, Mark. I just noticed your wrist brace.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions or comments on this, Chris?
Yeah, just a point of clarification. So I understand that the current Northern Channel Islands reserves are not to be messed with. But does that also suggest that no new MPAs could be proposed for that? For those islands?
I think the existing array of reserves is what they want to leave as is. So that just that is not to, that is to be considered done for the purposes of this process.
Any other questions or comments? And folks, if you would like to be called on, if you would put your name tag in a vertical position, that will help me here. Okay, let's move on to the Restored Habitats Work Group report. Jason's going to give that. If you recall, at the last meeting, we had a presentation by that work group. They received some comments and feedback from us. They've been working on that effort since the last meeting. There's an update to be given today. Jason?
Work group to revise the document that we presented to you last time and some of the
questions on or comments on the update? Okay, let's move on to the item number two on our agenda, the MPA Design Guidelines and Evaluation Methods. And before we get too involved with this, we want to remind folks that our procedure, and you can comment on this if you feel otherwise, but that unless the science team is proposing changes to guidelines or methods, the working assumption as we move through this process is that the existing guidelines or approaches that were used in the North Central Coast will be applied. Obviously, we're dealing here with habitat representation, size and spacing, habitat replication, levels of protection. But essentially, unless we make changes and approve those changes, we're working with those guidelines that were passed as part of the North Central Coast process. Any comments on that before we move on to the first major item, which is habitat representation? Okay, I'd like to call your attention to briefing document Roman numeral 2-1. This is a draft summary of methods used to evaluate MPA proposals in the MLPA South Coast Study Region. As we proceed through these sets of discussions, there will be information in this document that you might want to pull up and look at as we move along. This document was part of a package that was sent out, I think, last night or early this morning. The revision date on it is December 14th. 2008. I think there's some very minor revisions from the December 12th version, which you might have received earlier. So if you need a copy of that document, raise your hand and somebody with the magic memory stick will hopefully run around and service you. Meanwhile, we'll move on to habitat representation, and Mark Carr has the floor.
Thanks, Steve. So for this first section, it's what we want to accomplish about four or five things, if we can, over the next 30 minutes. And those are summarized here in this presentation. They make reference to those documents that Steve just referred you to, document D1, D2, D3, D4. And many of them are just minor alterations and additions that we want you guys to be aware of and approve. So what I want to do, first of all, is review the methods for evaluating habitat representation that we've been using and propose to use by the Science Advisory Team. I would then want to consider representation of unique habitats and what kind of guidance the SAT is going to give for those representations. The third issue there is to review and approve the addition of a couple of maps to the key and unique habitats document. And I'll show you those in the following slides so that you're familiar with those. They just they illustrate the distribution of those unique habitats. And then I want to turn to actually looking at the delineations of these bioregions that have been presented previously. And I've got a map to show that, and then review and approve the updates to that bioregion document, which is just incorporating a little bit more information on the analyses that were conducted. And then finally update on the status of GIS layers and expert review. And in fact, let me just give you that right now. As you know, the RSG and the SAT uses GIS layers to understand the distribution and abundance, or estimate the distribution and abundance of each of these different habitat types. The GIS folks have generated those layers, but more importantly, what we're doing now in the process of evolving those layers is running them past expert opinion. So, for example, I think one of the initial efforts was having Rich Ambrose look at the patterns or the delineations of wetland habitat. And so Rich has done that, provided feedback to the GIS group, and then they'll do that for each of those layers that we can. That's all I want to say on that topic, actually. The next thing is to consider the availability of key habitat. Oh, so this is how we go about doing the evaluation of the representativeness or representation of habitat types, right? So what I'm going to do is give you just 5 bullet points of how we are proposing, as we have in the past, doing the evaluation of habitat representation. So you start by considering the actual availability of each of the key habitats across the study region from Point Conception down to the Mexican border. We've talked about those key habitats previously, the different geomorphological features and the different depth zones for each of those features. Then we consider the distribution of those key habitats across the bioregions, right, to make sure that representation of those habitats where they occur in each bioregion is captured. Then we calculate the percentage of each key habitat that's protected across all the different protection levels that have been designated for those MPAs. And we highlight the habitats for which protection is not distributed across the 5 bioregions. So if a proposal has been generated that captures, say, kelp forests in 3 of the 5 bioregions, where in fact it's available across those regions, we simply point out that it's missing in some of these subregions. It's not represented in some of those bioregions. And then we note protection of unique habitats. And those unique habitats right now boil down to 2, maybe 3, oil seeps and hydrothermal vents, pelagophycus beds, and the purple coral allopera. So the next slide tries to show the distribution of those unique habitats. And I'm going to try and use the stump here to you can see that the hydrothermal vents and the oil seeps largely occur along the northern side of the Santa Barbara Channel, along the mainland. Yeah, I'm not allowed to use that. Yeah, and because of the stump. And this is just the northern part of the Southern California Bight, but that particular unique habitat is geographically restricted, to the best of our knowledge, to that portion of the coastline. Also on here is mapped the pelagophycus beds, which are, and these maps are being incorporated into the habitat representation map, but they show up. See those little green guys right there? Dang it, the stump won't do that. Hang on here. See right along here, and then down here's Catalina Island on the north face of the island. Let's slip down to the southern half of the bight, and you can see more clearly how pelagophycus beds are largely restricted to the northern side of both Catalina and San Clemente Islands, and a couple of spots down off La Jolla in the San Diego region. So that's the overall distribution of those unique habitat types. And I should mention that the third unique habitat type, the purple coral allopera, was not identified in the document that you have now. And one reason is because it's not very well mapped. The distribution of that particular habitat type is not well understood throughout the bight. Although we do know that that there is an abundance of it in the Farnsworth Bank area, and so we'll probably revisit the purple coral habitat later. Let me see if I can move. Okie doke. So we can return to this issue of how we want to treat these unique habitats, but that's one of the key things that we need to agree upon today. And one of the proposals that we have is that remember that the Act itself says that representative and unique habitats will be included within the array of the network of marine protected areas. And so they are meant to be represented within the MPAs. Given the limited distribution of these unique habitats, The way that we've treated unique habitats in the past is to simply identify whether or not a proposal, an MPA package, does or does not include those and to what extent they do, and left it at that. And so that's one thing that we'll want to get a feel for buy-in by the science advisory team on that approach to identifying and evaluating that representation. Let me back up. Okay, and then I want to move on now to the proposed. Pete.
I'm sorry, I wasn't here last time. Was there a discussion at all about soft-bottom kelp? Was that dismissed as a unique habitat?
It seems to have been, yeah. Yep. It's that one site, right, off of Point Conception.
Well, it goes from IV to Gaviota.
Yeah. Yep.
Just a quick question. Is the previous map, has it been provided to us? I can't find it. And when it goes up on the screen, I can't read it. So, yeah, this one.
Yeah, right.
Has it been provided to us? I can't find it.
I think it was only just sent out. Yeah.
We don't.
Yeah.
It was emailed with that document. It's sort of at the back of that document.
I don't see it in the document.
Which document? The TDD
Dash one?
No, it's D-1.
D-1.
It's briefing D-1 document D-1.
Was not sent to me.
It's Delta 1. It's in the one that got sent at 4 a.m.
Looking for the maps, they're at the tail end of document D1.
Okay. We're going to go through this pretty quickly. I think if we want, we can actually revisit those maps and talk about them in greater detail, and also revisit whether there's some unique habitats that have not been considered sufficiently. Okay. So moving on. The next topic is an update on the bioregions. And remember, you were presented the bioregions previously. What we want to do is talk about two things. One is the actual delineation of the boundaries of those bioregions. And then secondly, just a couple of additional documents that are analyses that are being incorporated into that bioregion document. Recall this is the five bioregions that we adopted last time in general, right? And these general distributions. This particular graph is changed as it's going into the document. Oh, I'm sorry. This particular document has been edited slightly, only in the sense that the previous version distinguished the subtitle from the intertidal sites that contributed to this analysis by two different sized markers. And that led to confusion by the RSG. They didn't understand what those different sized markers were. They were simply distinguishing whether they were subtitle or intertidal sites. Those now have been all made the same size to avoid that confusion. Okay, so given these general five patterns, what we're doing now is honing in on the actual delineations between these locations. And so you can see that the two mainland sites, this is the primary delineation of concern. The northern and the southern mainland bioregions, we propose to delineate right there at Marina del Rey, in the middle of Santa Monica Bay. And the rationale for that is because there are rocky reef habitats to the northern side of the bay, and then, of course, there's rocky reef habitat along the peninsula. So it seemed like the cleanest place to delineate those two areas was out in the middle of the stretch of sandy habitat in the bay. The other delineations are really obvious. So we have, for example, in the northern Channel Islands, it was presented previously that the western islands were distinguished from the eastern islands, and that boundary, as indicated in this inset, would run down and divide between Santa Rosa and Santa Cruz Islands. And then the other offshore bioregion is that of Clemente and Santa Catalina. And so those are pretty obvious natural separations. So we're proposing these specific delineations to the Science Advisory Team to get approval so that then these maps can be moved on to the RSG. And then finally, is quickly just to show you these last two graphics that show the differences in the relative abundance of species, right? The assemblage composition and structure across each of those proposed bioregions. And this one is based on shallow subtidal fish, invertebrates, and algae. And so they give people a feel for how the relative abundance of species vary on average between the sites within each of those regions, rather than some multidimensional scaling graphic, which we used earlier. And then likewise, this is the same sort of analysis for the rocky intertidal, showing once again how the relative abundance of species vary between those proposed bioregions. So that's it for all the new information. And so I think the thing to do is to now step back and see if there's any concern about the overall approach that we use for generating these habitat representation evaluations, looking at the relative availability and then the percent and distribution of a percent of those habitats that are represented in the proposed MPAs. And I've presented those kinds of analyses to you guys in the past. And I don't know if we want to make these motions as we go along from one to the next.
I think the key issue here is whether we're making a change in what was done in the past.
Right.
And I think the document, this is what's in the document.
Mm-hmm.
Just not exactly what you have to, what are we approving? That?
We're approving the method, yeah, not the document.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what we're looking to approve would be the material that Mark presented, which is not exactly represented verbatim in the document.
But it's captured.
But it's captured in the document.
Yeah.
So
let's go ahead and approve that, because there's no difference between the two other than the text. Yeah. I mean, other than
right.
The way it's paraphrased.
Okay, so you should be looking at the document 2:2.1. And in that document, when you get to the section on habitat representation analysis, there are four bullets describing evaluating habitat representation as to what the science advisory team considers. Is everybody in the same place on this? It's on the screen now. On both screens.
You know, that's this right here. It's the second slide. Let's do it. Or do you that's one thing we have to decide on. Do we want to go through now the unique habitats and then allow people to do public comment? Or do we went one by one?
Another piece to it, which is how this is being used. Let's get that on the table, too.
So what we're going to do... Okay, Dan, do you have a question?
When I look at these, is there a reason why, or should we think about connectivity between these habitats? Is that not to be considered at this time?
Not now. That's wholly separate. The connectivity bears on our size and spacing guidelines. This is strictly just representation of habitats within the MPAs across the bioregions in the study region.
Mary.
Just a minor comment, but in the second and fourth bullets, I think it should say not subregions, but bioregions. So just to get our language clear, you know, yeah. We're using the term subregions right. Just for the mapping units.
Yep.
But bioregion is the biogeographically relevant bioregion.
Yep. And in fact, let me just clarify that. There's confusion always because there's clearly the large-scale biogeographic regions, which I think everybody understands. But then the staff, initiative staff, for the purpose of generating these GIS layers and mapping habitats, have divided the coast into what they call subregions, okay, that don't have any ecological meaning per se. It's just a convenient way to break up the coastline or the study region in a way that they can map it. What we've been talking about are ecologically relevant bioregions. And so, unfortunately, in this text, for example, the term subregion is used instead of the term bioregion. Yeah. So that'll get changed in all of these. That'll be one key edit.
Is there any confusion on this, or are we all clear on this? Seeing great clarity in all these faces, we're all clear on this. If you're not, speak up now. Steve?
Well, I'm clear, but you asked a question about, the bioregions. Are we on taking a step back? Are we happy with where you're at? Do you want to address that question now?
I think we already approved the bioregions at the last meeting, and so what we were doing now is approving where those really specific delineations right. are.
I think what we have on the table before us are three decisions that we need to make. The first decision is, are we happy with these four bullets up here in terms of what the SAT will consider in evaluating habitat representation? And those four bullets in the text there would be as it is, with the exception of this subregion language, which would be converted into bioregion language. Mm-hmm. That's decision one. Decision two is, Mark pointed out in his presentation about how the unique habitats would be used during an evaluation process, which I believe he'll reiterate this before we get to that, but I believe it's simply they would be identified. And then the third decision to be made is whether everybody is comfortable with the specific delineations of those biological, what are we calling them, subregions?
Bioregions.
And those delineations were in Santa Monica Bay and between Santa Cruz and Santa Rosa Islands. Those are the three decisions that I believe we have to make in terms of what's been presented here today. Pete.
I just want to clarify these terms. So there's three terms. There's subregions, which is
a
mapping thing. There's bioregions, which are the five things, right?
Right.
And then there's biogeographic regions, which are like Point Conception South.
Exactly.
Got it.
Okay. Exactly. Yep. And remember never mind. Let's details.
So
can we go on to unique habitats now? Or before we...
go ahead.
Before we agree on those delineations, we need to revisit the delineations, get everybody's opinion. But we have to take public comment before we make those votes. So let's now turn, and so that we can capture all of these issues in the same public comment, let's turn to two things. What are the unique habitats and how are we going to treat those in the evaluations? Okay, so remember, originally we generated a series of four or five unique habitats. So the two of them, surf grass beds and eel grass beds, are in fact key habitats as well. They're sufficiently abundant that they have been identified as key habitats in the past, and they get evaluated as key habitats anyway, just like all the other key habitats. So the more important unique habitats are the pelagophycus beds, these oil seeps and hydrothermal vents, perhaps the purple corals, and then Pete has also identified these soft bottom macrocystis for us. Paul, is it? Go ahead, Paul.
I'm having problems with the mainland pelagophycus key habitat. Mm-hmm. And when do I get a chance to challenge that?
Right now. I think that now let's quickly go through each of those unique habitats, get feedback from you guys, and then with that feedback, agree upon which of those unique habitats move forward, and then quickly how we're going to approach the evaluation of those unique habitats in these proposals. So let's start with pelagophycus.
Is this a good time to do that? I've been accepting everything until I got to that.
Yeah, but, right on. Go ahead.
So my problem with that is that I think in at least in San Diego County, La Jolla and Point Loma, where I'm fairly familiar with it, it's ubiquitous within a depth zone. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, I don't see that any other species are associated with it in any important way. So I don't see it as a habitat. I see it as a species. It's a cool plant, but it's not a habitat in my mind. But maybe the most important concern is that it has order of magnitude fluctuations, I think. We've never really studied it, but it's pretty apparent, mm-hmm. with the regime shifts. And so in cold water years, there's a lot of it. We're in that now, but from 76 to 90 or 95 or so, during the warm water regime, it was very much reduced. So what happens if you're protecting it and the cold water regime goes away and it goes away?
Right.
So I'm concerned about having that as a habitat, but that's my only concern. It's a cool plant. I'm happy to protect it.
Yeah, right. No, that's an excellent point, actually. Because that is the idea that there's some aspect of, in this case, a biogenic structure that actually creates a habitat per se. And so, in fact, we could make that extension to the oil seeps and the hydrothermal vents where it does appear that there is, in fact, some unique assemblage associated with those structures or those features as opposed to, in this case, pelagophycus. Chris?
Well, I thought you were about to say what I was going to say, but you said the opposite. So I was thinking with the oil seeps, those are not going to be around forever. And so it's a similar kind of thing. Instead of fluctuating from year to year, it could be that 50 years from now, they're gone. So what are we really protecting?
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know what the predicted persistence of that is. Let's, as I alluded to earlier, I made the comment that remember the Act says that these unique habitats are to be represented, but what we can do is in the SAT, in our evaluation approach, is simply identify whether in fact or not these things were in the proposed packages, and then leave it to the BRTF to decide how important that is. Given the ephemeral, either in the short term or the long term, nature of these particular habitats, the extent to which they support unique species assemblages, and the extent to which fishing has any impact on these habitats as well, right? Dominique, did you?
I think you covered it, Mark, but I was just commenting on the long-term ephemeral nature of the oil seeps. They've been around since the Pleistocene. I don't think within any time frame that we need to worry about that.
There's a lot of evidence that they decrease in
I'm not sure I buy into that, because some of those seeps are very shallow formations that aren't being tapped by the deeper oil-bearing formations from the platforms.
I think at this time, at this point, given that they exist, we simply have to acknowledge their presence, and then we simply have to agree on how we want to treat these habitats in the evaluation. Ray, you're not on there.
Is oil drilling prohibited in the higher levels of protection, and particular is, even if the platform isn't there, does it prohibit coming underneath and extracting oil from inside the reserves, in state marine reserves?
I don't think we have any control over that. Is that right?
I just wanted to add one thing. I see the difference between the oil seeps and the elk kelp is, as far as I understand, this is an adaptive process. So in 50 years from now, if there are no more oil seeps, then the state can decide to revisit this and make changes to the MPAs, right? We're not... what we do here in this process is not set in stone. It can be changed down the line. Is that correct?
Could I repeat that?
That this is an adaptive process, and so if something is, if we anticipate something might disappear in 50 to 100 years, that's irrelevant, because the reserves can be changed in that time. That the state can come back and revisit those issues.
Right. So can I get a feel from the SAT whether this approach for evaluating the representation of unique habitats by simply identifying whether or not they were captured in a proposed package is sufficient evaluation? I think it'd be good to get there as we go on to consider some of these other habitat types.
Is it enough? I mean, when they're represented within a particular plan, is there any criteria, or was there any criteria that says how much? I mean, as an example, there's plagiophagus in a lot of places.
That's right.
And so would there be the same level of
like percent,
area or percentages or
yeah, percent relative
or,
to availability?
Yeah. No?
We have not done that in the past, largely because they were limited enough that either they were or they weren't in an MPA. But we could do that, right? In the case of pelagophagus, where we think we may know its distribution, its current distribution, we can say how much of it is captured, especially if, to the extent that it's less ephemeral along the northern side of Catalina and Clemente, which seems to be the larger portion of the range of that particular species. The other consideration, as Paul's pointed out, is a unique habitat, or just an interesting, not relatively rare species.
Chris,
yeah, I mean, Mark, I basically endorse what you said, but with just one caveat: that isn't there kind of a level of protection issue here that we don't want the BRTF to be. Think, oh, unique habitat, it must be protected, and then it'll be preserved. And when really, if fishing doesn't really impact anything, then why does it matter whether it's in or out of an MPA network? So should we say something about that?
I think it'd be good to articulate that, yes. Yep.
Let's move on to the biogeographic delineations. We'll take a couple more questions on this, and then we'll move on, take public comment, move through each of these issues to make final decisions. I have Dominic and Steve, and then we'll move on.
This is just a question. So on pages 5 and 6, you have kind of a table of a set of key habitats. But my question has to do with, the list of key habitats is a little bit longer than this. So, like, for example, pinnacles is not on this list. So I'm just asking to find out why certain key habitats
were incorporated and others weren't.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, I guess the unique habitat group made those decisions as to which kind of came up out of the list to merit consideration in this document. And if you want to add, if the SAT wants those put back in, let's just do it right now. Just say, I want to see the soft bottom Macrocystis beds identified as unique habitat and see if that's approved or not, and pinnacles.
And if I might just kind of clarify, and this is maybe for my own clarification, maybe I'll help myself out as I talk through this, but there's a difference between key habitats and unique habitats. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
There is a difference there.
There is, and that's where the confusion, though. You're being brought into this confusion that eelgrass and surf grass are also identified as key habitats. So why are these two also identified in unique habitats? Only because relative to other key habitats, these are far less abundant. But, in fact, they are abundant enough that they merit key habitat consideration anyway. And in so doing, they're going to be evaluated like every other key habitat.
Okay, so then in terms of, for example, the pinnacles, we have those in the key and unique habitats document. We do have those listed as key habitats and not necessarily unique habitats, just key habitats.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that's what I was just using that one example.
There's another one. Right on, where there's overlap between key and unique.
Yeah.
And again, it's the same idea. It was recognized as key, but because of its relative rareness, it was given that unique consideration. In this case, I think the only one we know of is Farnsworth that's been mapped.
Okay, we have Steve.
Mark just answered my question, but Jason has one.
Jason?
Yeah, I was just going to throw two things out.
Habitat, excuse me, document. I noticed in the text it mentions habitats like upwelling centers and retention areas, but it doesn't really bring it into the tables. How would that be treated? And if it's, you know, if it's not going to be addressed, I'd like to propose that we do bring habitats like the upwelling centers and retention areas into the analysis.
Into the key habitats as a key habitat.
Okay, because it's the way that it's in the document. I don't, and this might be, you know, not the right time to be discussing this, but it doesn't seem like it's being addressed in the analysis. It's kind of like, oh, by the way, these are important habitats, but it's not going to be something that's addressed. I'm not
right.
Maybe I misread that, or
no, that's actually a correct interpretation. I mean, it's been identified as a key habitat, or to consider as a key habitat as we go from one study region to the next. And in the past, we have not identified the percent of those oceanographic habitats that were captured in the MPAs, but that can be done.
Okay. I would like to propose that's
the GIS people will kill us all, but but we'll see what
we'll buy
we
them
do.
Some wine.
I mean, that's a lot of it. A lot of it is literally, technically, can it be done? And so what we can do is see if we can capture that.
And it, yeah, in terms of areas, maybe not, but at least we have predictable areas where we could say.
And that's where they're almost essentially like unique habitats, where we can say, look, off Palos Verdes or off the southern coast of some of these islands, we know that upwelling is more extensive there than in other portions of the study region. Were these represented in the proposals or not?
Okay.
Quick comment from here. You know, what I'm hearing is that we've had some suggestions and some comments about what should or shouldn't constitute a unique habitat. We've had some comments about the elk kelp beds. We've had comments about the oil seeps. We've had some comments about the softer bottom, less stable Macrocystis communities. So that's one side of the issue on the unique habitats about, well, what are they, and are we in agreement with that? The other side of the issue is the approach that Mark outlined that would be taken during an evaluation with this collection of unique habitats. And that approach is maybe something we should just spend a moment on to see whether we agree or do not agree with. And if I recall, Mark's delineation of that approach was that each package that would be submitted would simply be looked at to see whether these unique habitats were or were not included in the MPAs presented in that package. And that would be the evaluation, presence or absence. Okay, so let's have a comment or two on that, on the approach. Anybody have any disagreement with that approach? Rich?
So if it was truly a unique, geographically restricted habitat, that approach would make sense. But when you're talking about something like oil seeps, it's spread out over a larger geographic range, and so if you had one oil seep in there, that doesn't seem to me to be the same as having half of the oil seeps in there or something like that.
So
I think something that's more quantitative, like
yep.
a proportion
yep.
of the available habitat or something like that would be more reasonable.
And we just have to generate, we could get into the details of this later, but how you try to estimate the abundance of that habitat. And so, for example, the oil seeps, to the extent that they're restricted near shore and relatively linear, like subtidal rocky reefs, which we use a linear metric for the abundance of that habitat,
right.
We could perhaps do that then with the oil seeps.
Right. So sometimes that might have to do something like that, some indicator. Mm-hmm. And then in other cases, like the hydrothermal vents off of Palos Verdes, that then is really a unique one. And so it wouldn't, it's either in or out.
Yeah.
But for other ones, it seems like it would have to be some indicator of how of the magnitude of
abundance.
Inclusion.
Yep. So we can do that with that particular habitat. Can we, before Chris, when it comes to Pelagophagus, Paul made the argument that this may not in fact be a unique habitat per se. Do we want to revisit that and take it off the list? If it stays on the list, then we could simply do the same thing where we look at the relative abundance of that species within the proposed MPAs.
Okay, I have Dan, Pete, Steve.
Just want to clarify what I think Paul said. Paul was talking about Pelagophagus in San Diego County. So the ephemeral nature of those Pelagophagus beds at, for instance, the inside of Catalina Island is not ephemeral.
But
they're very persistent and, are in large expanses out on soft bottom habitat. So mm-hmm. I think taking them off I would believe Paul and take him off at San Diego County, because right. No one's going to know more about it than him. But taking him off of the whole bite might not be the prudent thing.
Well, the second part, so there's two aspects of his argument. One is the ephemeral nature. The other is, does it actually support any species assemblage that's different than, say, Macrocystis adjacent to it? Or is it just another one of the kelps in the mix of a forest?
Pete, Steve, are you still up, Steve? Pete first, Steve, and then Paul.
I want to get to the term habitat, because as expressed by Paul, we're talking about what we normally consider to be habitat, which is an assemblage of things and the, sort of the structure. The same criticism or comment would apply to Lapra, too, I would think. I mean, what you're talking about is the Lapra's probably not fundamentally altering the habitat, yet it's a species that doesn't occur very many places, and in other places along the coast it's been distinguished as a species worth protecting. Mm-hmm. Plagioflicus might serve in that same capacity. Macrocystis in the north, sandy bottom, might be the same in the sense that, you know, it's a habitat altering structure in sand, and it's the only place in the world that it occurs on soft bottoms, and in that sense it's, you know, kind of, in that sense it is absolutely unique in the context of sand, not in the context of the species. And so right. We need to really, I don't know that we, when we crafted the word habitat, that we had in mind what ecologists come to mean as habitat. I think it was broader than that. That may not have been the correct thing to do, but it was clearly in other conversations broader than what we typically mean as habitat.
So yours, I mean, the way I interpret your statement, we really meant, When we identified habitat as just something that created structure, physical habitat,
or something so rare,
and was rare
and of interest. I mean, you know, we can't diminish that term interest to people, the public, or to groups or whatever. That it's been identified for protection in other places, like a Lapra. You know, there are species like that that don't, I would argue that they don't change very much about what's going on. I think Plagioflicus is not that type of species, but a Lapra is. But, and yet, in a lot of places and groups have thought of it as being completely worthy of protection. And so we've used it more broadly than than what we typically mean as habitat.
Let's go to Steve Morgan.
Well, a lot of this conversation is really getting to the point I wanted to make. And so, you know, this confusion between key and unique is one of the things that doesn't really help, but I would consider this to be unique, maybe to this region. But it's not unique in terms of the species assemblage, but it is key in terms of providing habitat structure, much as the way surf grass and the other sorts of things that are listed in here. So, you know, maybe Paul can weigh in.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yep, I think I agree with everything I've heard, but the point I wanted to make, and I tried to be careful with it, was I was worrying about, I wouldn't mind taking the mainland Plagioflicus off of the list, but the island ones are somewhat a different story, and I don't know what species are obligated to that habitat, but there's a lot of stuff on them, and they do change the current around the bottom. Mm-hmm. You know, I would actually debate that for the mainland ones. So I think, in things like a Lapra, I think we need to protect. So I'm just worried about the mainland Plagioflicus
right.
as a key habitat.
We are taking quite a bit of time on this. What I want to do is I want to move to this delineation of the biogeographic boundaries. We'll take public comment. We'll then come back and vote on the evaluation, the four bullets on habitat representation. We'll vote on the biogeographic delineations, and then we'll have some last words on whether or not we think we're prepared to make any approvals on this key and unique habitat. Otherwise, we'll jam this whole agenda for the rest of the day. Yeah. So let's move to the biogeographic delineations. I just need to ask whether there's any comments. Any comments on those delineations?
Are we okay with that?
Steve Weisberg.
I think what you've done is wonderful, but the things that you were hitting earlier, Mark, mm-hmm. about a delineation concerned me a tiny bit in the sense that not you put them in the wrong place, but you've treated them as a static single number or single location.
Location.
And my concern is that in working with a lot of this data, obviously we have warm years and we have cold years, and the species that are part of that eco or the mm-hmm. bioregion move pretty substantially.
Yeah, they do, but you know, in our calculations of the bioregions incorporated that temporal variability.
I guess those
regions that we came up with, you're talking about the actual delineations as opposed to the regions themselves.
Exactly. I think you have the correct regions, but by putting a hard line as mm-hmm. the end of the region and then implying that if you were to grab a small section that's, say, yeah. just south of that line, you know, you are adequately representing that region, you might not be in a cold
yeah.
year. You might be, in a sense...
Yeah, and I think the kicker here is where the only place where we seem to really put a hard line is along that mainland, the northern-southern delineation, and that, in fact, is why we thought, let's slap it out in the middle of the bay so that there's enough flexibility across that, right?
Okay.
But the problem is that the RSG needs to have a line. They whether we like it or not, recognize. I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I mean, you've made a really good point. If there's any place that's spatially dynamic, we're here. And
I'm thinking as an alternate is maybe provide them that line, but also identify them some sort of zone of overlap. Let's say that this area is a little bit less true. And in a sense, if you're going to try and pick an area to essentially protect that bioregion, this area in kind of this gray zone in the middle is less true
uh-huh.
to that bioregion. So they have that additional information as they're making their decision.
And so that zone of overlap right now, what are you thinking would be the...
I'd have to go back and look at some of the data, but it's pretty sizable. I mean, when we get a warm year, you get some pretty...
Yeah.
Pretty large incursions of those species into...
But it's going to have to be fine enough that it's useful. If it's such a huge overlap area that there's so much play in it, then it's going to be very difficult to give guidance and evaluation to these guys.
Pete Bramondi.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on that. The hard line that bothers me most is not the one that's along the mainland. I think the one along the mainland is a very strong hard line. We've got support for it genetically. We've got support for it with respect to communities. The hard line that bothers me, but there's nothing we can do about it, is the one that's between Santa Cruz and Santa Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically off the table as far as I understand. And so, because those sites have already been approved by the Fish and Game Commission, right? We've been told earlier today we're not going to talk about replication, sizing, spacing on the northern Channel Islands. Is that not right, Jason? I mean, that's basically the message that we were given earlier.
One important caveat to that, though, is that they are on the table to be included in the evaluations.
Yeah.
And right. So but we're not going to set up new replication. We're not going to do anything with those things. And so, you know, I think that I agree. In fact, the real line for us is about halfway through Santa Cruz.
Right.
And but logistically, that's such a difficult thing to try to enforce or to, and that was set up actually when we thought we might be doing something in the Northern Channel Islands. We now know that we're not going to. I'm very convinced that line at Marina Del Rey is as strong as we're going to get in this region.
Okay, Dan.
Just a quick comment about the where the line ends at Point Conception. I think last meeting we discussed that perhaps the Vandenberg Reserve would be included in analyses because it's continuous with San Miguel. Do we want to include that in this map? Because if there were in terms of replication, that reserve would count, even though it's outside the study region.
This is the Vandenberg?
The Vandenberg
right.
one, because it's continuous with the San Miguel, Santa Rosa.
Bioregion.
Yeah, do we want to try to put that on this map somehow so that's
well,
obvious?
Well, we can consider it in the replication, right, within that bioregion.
It would be considered, correct? So
yep.
That might be important if you're drawing, if you're on the stakeholder group and drawing a map, that to know that would, even though it's outside the study region, it will be included.
Absolutely. For
okay.
connectivity as well as replication within
Yeah, so
yes.
I don't know if we want to modify the map to to show that, because right now it's not included as part of that blue bioregion.
Okay, let's move on to take public comment on these issues, and then we'll have room for another comment or two when we get back to making these decisions. Anybody would like to provide public comment? And we're only taking public comment on this particular topic, which is habitat representation at this point in time. Do you have a card? Get up to the front.
You want to do 2 minutes? We have 2 minutes for each person. Now, I only have one card that is specific to this agenda item. Do you want to be on number two, Dave? Okay. So, but I will ask the other the cards that have been submitted. Okay. So all right, so let's Mr. Romanowski, did you want to comment on this, or do you want general comment? The general comment, the public comment will be right after lunch, which is general comment. This is just on this specific item and things that have been discussed here this morning.
The only concerns I have about this, I want to make general comments, but my biggest concerns for this is the thing that we haven't seen is that a lot of these habitats can change with weather conditions like what we have now. Many of these different things. We have no mechanism in place, and the process as a whole does not have a mechanism because you can't stop Mother Nature from changing it. And so this is a serious thing. I mean, it doesn't affect things like oil seeps and things on the bottom, but there are a lot of zones where you can't stop the water from coming in. You couldn't stop pollution from coming down if you tried, because unless they're willing to stop all growth to the inland parts of California, which is impossible, you're not going to stop some of the habitat damage. Furthermore, there's no mechanism there's nothing you can do if outside pollution were to come in, take down eelgrass, say. There's nothing you can do to regrow that eelgrass if that condition is simply going to keep returning and has nothing to do with the coast or the ocean. The people who are actually on the coast, the people who are actually using the ocean on a daily basis, even for that matter, they don't have any control over that, and it's not caused by them. So by limiting a lot of people's access to all these coastal areas on the premise that we're trying to protect something that there is no physical way to protect, you're protecting it from people who are not doing any of the damage to it. So I'm hoping that they will take some of that into consideration when you look at how these habitats are going to be protected. The fact that a boat anchor is not what is going to destroy the whole place, or a jet ski driving through it, or a fishing rod going into the water or something, that's not going to do the damage to it nearly so much as, you know, fertilizer coming from Norco coming down the Santa Ana River right now has just wiped everything out for 10 miles in every direction, and it will be damaged for 6 months or 3 months or whatever it's going to be. So that's basically my comment about that, is I hope that they take that part into consideration, outside factors that are beyond our control along the coastline. Other than that, I'll see you in the general comments.
Thank you. Joel Greenberg.
Good morning, science team. I'm Joel Greenberg, and I'm on the South Coast Regional Stakeholder Group, and that's the hat that I'm wearing, which I have to lift off this morning and scratch my head wondering some of what you were talking about, how to interpret it. And it's not because I'm unfamiliar with the terminology, it's because I guess we haven't reached a decision point. But the one thing that I did notice, and this is recognizing, you know, that Dr. Weisberg's comments had validity, when you get down to the practicality of how sharp that edge is between the bio subregions, the two that matter are the along the coast ones, and where they join up is in Santa Monica Bay. And my feeling about that is, over the years, species assemblages within the bay don't change radically, and it doesn't matter which part of the decadal shift you're in, the cold years or the warm years, abundance changes quite a bit. But you're not going to suddenly see things there that you've never seen. And the other thing is that, well, it's very well protected in the sense that there's almost no commercial fishing allowed in the bay, 3 miles. So I think it's a moot point to worry about how hard that edge is, quite frankly. I don't think that's going to make much difference one way or another on our proposals. Just my guess so far from what I understand. And that's all the comment I had for now on this. I'll be back up here a little later. Thank you.
Okay, we have Buck Everingham, followed by Stacy Fedgick.
Yeah, as one of the RSG members who's not real computer-oriented, I would like to ask if it's possible for the SAT team to put together pictures with names of these plants you're talking about on the bottom and the corals, because in the lack of best available science, we're being, as consumptive RSG members, are being asked to fill in the gaps. And there's a good chance I know about a lot of these, but I don't know what plant you're talking about. So if I could just have a picture, we may be able to be a lot more helpful. And that's all I have to ask. Thank you.
Thank you. Stacy, and I'm assuming Jenny Marshall, that will be at the general comments. Then after Stacy will be Karen Martin.
So talking about Plagiophagus, my name is Stacy Fatek. I'm representing the Santa Monica Bay Keeper. I think that when you consider Plagiophagus as a key habitat, we can't really say if it's key. There's just simply not enough research to know. But like seagrass and eelgrass, that it has to build, and we just don't know. There's very little research on it. It is definitely a cool plant. But protecting these areas will potentially change fishing habits in Point Loma. Right now, we talk about the effects of spillover and how the Macrocystis beds could be acting naturally as the spillover into the Plagiophagus beds, potentially acting as your refuge. I'm not saying that they're different species, but that there is definitely a spillover and an exchange. And with the research showing that there is definitely a decrease in fish populations within the Macrocystis beds in Point Loma, my work, and once again, I was doing research on Plagiophagus itself and not on the fish species. I see a lot more fish there. And so we wonder if we're seeing fishermen's habits change. They fish right on the edge of the beds. And so if we protect the Plagiophagus beds, we'll move them out further and potentially protect those areas as well. Thank you.
Paul Weakland will be the next speaker after Ms. Martin.
Thank you very much. I'm Karen Martin. I'm a professor of biology at Pepperdine University. I'm very interested in the sandy beaches, and I noticed this was mentioned in passing at the last meeting, and I just saw it on the overhead just a moment ago, the designation of 1 linear mile in length for beaches, for sandy beaches, to capture all the biodiversity. When we saw it last time, Jenny Dugan and I asked about it among each other, where did they get that number? And we couldn't figure it out, and I noticed that you say no data. That's where you got that number. So I'm a little concerned about that. I'd like to suggest a couple of other ways of looking at beach habitats. One would be the width of the beach. A long beach right in front of some houses is very different from a long beach that's backed up by more beach or by bluffs or by dunes. Pocket beaches are also very important. In fact, they're biologically different. They're considered their own special category. And around here, pocket beaches are often less disturbed by human impacts and also less accessible to vehicle impacts. So they have a special place in the hearts of beach biologists. In addition, those broader, wider beaches will have more access for the other components, the terrestrial components of the beaches, such as the bird uses, such as roosts, foraging, and nesting, and for the marine mammal and the sea turtle haulouts. So I just want to make sure that we understand that the beach is also has a depth to it, a width to it, and also the steepness, the wave regime. Of course, if they're in a bay versus on an open coast, they're going to be very different from each other. So I just want those things to be brought before this group while you think about how you're going to decide where the sandy beaches are. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul Weakland, followed by Dave Rudy.
Paul Weakland. Can we get this right? We're only specific issue here. General comments will be held later. Don't run off like the past speakers. All right, let's talk about the biogeography. We're talking about one thing and one thing only. What are you here to do? Stop fishing. All the only activity that you're going to curtail is fishing. So why are you talking about species that are not going to be fished, like purple coral? Who harvests that? seems insignificant and immaterial about this elaborate, most complex, we're getting confusion now, about one-on-a activity that you were talking about stopping, and that is fishing. So who decides what species you're going to investigate with all this gobs of grant money? And the biogenetic diversities and the areas in which you're fished brings up the most important part that I say, who is paying for this? Who is allowing you to stray off into these bioregions? Who's allowing you to develop beyond the parameters of what you were assigned? Are these foundations that we were told last time? Five foundations are paying these millions of dollars to get what? Well, they must have something that they're after. Is it just a nonprofit write-offs? Or is it actually they are buying harvest rights for their aquariums? Are there other schemes? You don't talk about aquaculture in these biogeoregions. I think that aquaculture should not be allowed, but you don't even want to touch on that subject. You're not going to allow fishing, but are you going to allow aquaculture? These regions are very fragile, and this is why the whole initiative is started. Why is there no criteria for failure? I'll have other comments later.
Dave Rudy, followed by Mike McCorkle.
Good morning, science team. My name is Dave Rudy. I'm a regional stakeholder group. My name is Dave Rudy. I'm a regional stakeholder in the regional stakeholder group. I've been diving in Southern California, mostly San Diego, Orange County, and the islands for the last 30 years. Anyway, I'd like to speak a little about Plagiophycus. Some years it's there, some years it's not, just like Paul said. And it's generally on the outside of the kelp. It mixes with the Macrocystis, but it generally extends a little further offshore. I don't really see it as a unique habitat. It comes and goes, and I've seen it in different places, different years. As far as really unique habitats, it seems like the pinnacles and the Allopora, the purple coral, that's a unique habitat. It doesn't seem like Plagiophycus is either a habitat or unique. That's my comment.
Thank you. Mike McCorkle. Bruce, did you want to speak on this subject as well? Okay. Followed by Bruce Steele.
Mike McCorkle, I have some comments on oil seeps, protecting oil seeps. And I've fished around oil seeps for over 50 years with every kind of commercial fishing gear you could probably imagine. I also work once in a while on boats that go out and repair the tents at Platform Holly, Platform A, pipelines that leak. Most oil seeps I see have gas with them. You have gas coming up. In fishing around them, I don't see where stopping fishing to protect an oil well is going to, or gas seep is going to, natural oil seep, is going to do anything. The stuff that grows around them seems to stay, as far as I can see, really stable. It changes a little bit at different times of year, the different kinds of growth that's around there. But one of the things that I think happens is also, especially in the Santa Barbara Channel, you've got a lot of oil seeps, and they don't all seep every day the same amount, and the gas doesn't come up all the time the same amount. I've never talked to anybody yet that explained to me why one day gas is coming up real heavy and the next day it's coming up real light. What makes it do it? In my mind, I'm thinking about atmospheric pressure pushing on the earth makes it change. I don't know, but one of the things I think that happens there that you're not taking into account if you're worried about the stuff that lives there, there's a big sediment flow in the Santa Barbara Channel, and it buries stuff all the time, especially when you get heavy rainy weather and runoff from the Santa Clara River and out of Gaviota and out of different places. And these places can get all covered up. The oil's going to keep coming up because it eats a hole. You can, you know, if you see it with a ROV or something, you can see how it's coming up. But so that changes the whole bottom a lot of times. So to stop fishing around them, I don't think it is going to do any good.
Mike,
the last question I have would be. If we're going to protect oil seeps, are we going to only protect big oil seeps? We're going to protect little baby oil seeps? What will be the level of protection? Thank you.
Bruce Steele and Jenny Marshall, did you have a comment on this? Well, no, you'll do a general comment. Okay, great. Thank you. This will be our last public comment.
I guess I am lean over. And I'd like to talk about, back up what Dan said about sources and retention zones. When we did the Merwig, we referred to them as sources and sinks. But in our regional profile, there's no document that gives us any indication of where those are. There's no mapping. There's only a mention of upwelling off of Conception. And an issue that I've been carrying for a while is ocean acidification. It's not mentioned in the document, but it is retention zones or something that maybe we should be looking at in the long run, that they may be more have some value as far as persistence in a lot of species as we move forward. And kind of along the same line, I think when a group of people get together like this and then kind of ignore an issue like as big as that issue really is, I think we're really missing the boat, that there's not a whole lot of time for us to actually get out and start educating the public about what's, you know, what the future holds. So at any rate, I think sources and sinks is something that really needs to be mapped out a lot better than what we have in our document.
Thank you. That concludes the public comment on this particular issue. Of course, we have several times, and one designated in particular, where we will be seeking public comment. So if we look at this, can you put up the on the screen the four bulleted items on evaluating habitat representation? Can we get those up there? This is your document, Roman numeral 2.1. In evaluating habitat representation, the SAT considers the availability of habitats across the entire study region, the availability of habitats within the biogeographically relevant bioregions, the percentage of available habitat protected in MPAs across all six levels of protection, and the distribution of habitat protection across the biogeographically relevant bioregions. Those are the four bullets. That is how the SAT will be evaluating habitat representation. So we need a motion to approve that particular evaluation protocol. Can I have that motion, Pete?
I'll make that motion.
Moved by Pete, seconded by Dan. Any discussion or comments on this? Okay, all those in favor, raise your hands. Opposed? Any abstentions? That passes. Second would be the biogeographic delineations. Those are those lines that Mark showed us that occur between Santa Rosa and Santa Cruz Island and Marina Del Rey and Santa Monica Bay. As Pete pointed out, as of this point in time, the issue with Santa Rosa, Santa Cruz has really already been resolved with respect to the existing Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary MPAs. So can I hear a motion to adopt those delineations? Moved by Steve Weisberg. Have a second?
I'll second it.
Who did that?
Right here.
Dominic, any comments on this? All in favor of the delineations, raise your hand. Any opposed? Any abstentions? That gets us to the third topic that was discussed. And I want to try to see if I can encapsulate this for a quick moment. So the two issues that we really have spent most of our time discussing are the issue of unique habitats, how to identify them, what are they, and then secondly, the approach that would be used to incorporate unique habitats into the SAT's assessments of MPA packages. Mixed in with that is the issue of key habitats. We already know that key habitats are to be represented, and all of that language about habitat representation applies to them, and I think we already have figured out with our passing of our first motion what we're doing with key habitats. So with regard to unique habitats, if I understand where we are, in terms of the approach that we'd like to see is, first of all, to record the presence of unique habitats, whatever they are, in MPAs, in these packages, and then secondly, to work to attempt to provide information regarding some measure of abundance or representation of those unique habitats in what the MPA packages are. At this point in time, we don't have anything more definitive with regard to what that should be, whether it should be a percent of the total availability. And we have to realize that in a lot of cases, we have relatively weak information about what is where. But that's what I think I've heard as a summation with regard to the group. They want to know where, want to record their presence and like to have something a little bit further with regard to representation. Anybody like to comment on that?
Chris does.
Chris.
Yeah, I'm just reiterating something I asked earlier, but and I'll drop it if no one agrees, but I'd just like to propose that we include to that list that the SAT provides some information about the effect of fishing on those on those unique habitats.
Okay. Anything else? Dominic.
I agree with that last statement, but just to add to it, I don't know if it's just fishing or if it's take. I mean, there are other types of take than fishing.
And it is. It is. I think that's what we ought to do is go a little step further. I think we need to capture what Chris mentioned and then go a step further to see if we can identify other sources of take. And if I can give even further clarification or resolution on Steve's point, it seems to me that there's three of these what have fallen into the unique habitat category: Pelagophicus, the oil seeps, and then, of course, the grass beds, that are abundant enough that we could quantify the relative, the percent that's captured within proposed MPAs. The others that we don't have, for example, corals, the best of our knowledge is that it's largely focused or restricted to the Farnsworth Bank area, but the reality is we just don't have good enough maps to make those kinds of estimates of percent of representation. So that's one where we could simply identify whether or not we know it's been captured in an MPA. So that's what I would move forward on, how we would assess the representation of unique habitats.
Pete?
This is a little tangential perhaps, but I just noticed something up on the board that I didn't say and is not true. And so I wanted to make sure that before anything's adopted, that's clarified. It says natural oil seeps are unique to California, which is not true, and Pete Romani pers com, which I didn't say. And so I want to, and what it might mean is that they're mostly found in Southern California when in California, but there's oil seeps all over the world. And so I don't want that to be represented in this document, especially not attributed to me.
What do you say we don't agree with that? Yeah, that can be edited quickly.
So are you proposing an individual analysis for each unique habitat type? Is that what I'm hearing?
Correct. And actually, I should, and we could also make sure that we address the oceanographic habitats as key habitats.
From my perspective, Pete, we're not approving this written document. Yeah, and this is one of those synchronous things. Go ahead, Dominic.
Just a question on the maps. So, you know, the maps are really good. I think they're a good first step, but I think that there's some things that might need to be improved. Like, for example, Farnsworth Bank needs to be identified on the map, and maybe the hydrothermal vent at White Point. You know, so my question is, we're not approving the maps or that document right now, and we have room to change that, right?
My take on this is that if we vote on this, we're approving the approach, not the document, not the maps, simply the approach.
Okie doke. So I was going to say, I think one thing we will do is bring back the text of the document for your approval, given that we want to articulate the potential fishing impacts or not on these habitat types and other kinds of extractive activities.
So the elements of the approach would be to, for unique habitats, record their presence, provide information on their relative abundance, you know, in terms of what's been captured in MPAs, and I think as Mark pointed out, that'll be variable depending upon what the unique habitats are and what information is available. And then three, comment during the evaluation on the impacts of take or activities that might be regulated by MPAs on those unique habitats. So can I hear a motion to approve that approach? Dan moves. Have second. Chris? Any comments on that? All those in favor, raise your hands. Opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, good. We're going to take a 3-minute break, like 5-minute break. We got some wiring to do, and then we got to come back and get to work. Oh, by the way, parking validations, where's our person? Parking validations back there.